Good morning.
Good morning.
It's good to see you here this morning. So we're continuing on in this series, You Were Made for This Moment, understanding 1 Peter then and now for guidance and inspiration in our present circumstances. I don't know how many of you recall, but back in the 1980s, it was probably, in terms of the church and culture, it was probably the last gasp of the church to try and establish firmly the Judeo-Christian worldview in our culture. And so there was the rise of the fundamentalist movement in the 1980s, late 1970s, that sought to leverage the politics to codify a Christian world and life view in the world in which we live. So that was called really culture wars 1.0. If any of you remember that, Jerry Falwell and that particular group. After a period of time, the church summarily lost that culture war, and from that point on, the media and higher education and politics always sought to define or to describe the church over in the image of that particular fundamentalist group, but from the 1980s. So they were always perceived as being judgmental and intolerant and hateful, narrow-minded, bigoted. Those kinds of adjectives were used to describe that particular group. And so the media, the higher education, politics have hung on to those descriptions as they describe the church even today. So after the 1980s, and when the church kind of lost the culture war 1.0, we entered into the 1990s, and then about 2006, maybe 2008, we hit a new stage in our world in which we live. Well, I will just say from the 1980s up until about 2006, 2007, there was a period of what I would call détente between the church and between the culture. They kind of did their thing, we did our thing. They didn't pay any attention to us, and we just didn't pay any attention to them. And so we lived in this with this uneasy truce between the church and within and the culture, the secular culture itself. But then 2007, 2008, it all switched. And it switched mightily. So in the 1980s, the church said to the culture, you have to think, you have to believe, you have to value. We are, after all, they said, a Christian nation. So therefore, you have to believe, you have to think, you have to value, you have to do the way that we are supposed to do according to the scriptures. They lost that battle. But in 2007, 2008, the culture began to say to the church, you have to do. You have to think. You have to value what we do. And if you don't, we're going to litigate against you. And so now, since that time, the shrillness of that battle has continued to gain over the course of what would be, say, 15 years. And so now we live in a world that continues to define people like you and me as bigoted and hateful and intolerant and all of those kinds of things, while at the same time, much of the culture leveraging itself against the church, saying, if you don't think this way, if you don't believe this way, if you don't do these things, then we're going to take you to court, or we're going to do this, or we're going to do that. Now, fortunately, those effects have been muted. They have not been as dramatic as those people who are against the church would like it to be. But we now live in a culture that is more adversarial towards the church than any time since we've been born as a nation. Now, I raise all of that because there are some parallels and some similarities between what the church is experiencing today and what Christians experienced in the first century. There was a lot of misunderstanding and misperception about what Christians really were and what Christians were really about. And there was a lot of negative press back then as there is today. And if you're like me, maybe you have a conversation with a person now and then who thinks that they know what Jesus really was about, who thinks they know what the church is really about, who thinks that they know what the average Christian is really like. And then when they have a conversation with you, you're like, this doesn't comport with what I've been told. I was told Jesus was this, but you're telling me he's that. I was told the church acted like this, but now I see that it's not how the church really acts. I was told that Christians are basically this way, but you don't seem to be that way at all. And so we have this massive kind of PR battle that we have to fight that has to be very authentic, very real, very organic in the lives of people with whom we rub shoulders with, work with, live with in our neighborhoods and things like that. So the Apostle Peter then was trying to address those Christians who were living in a world that was pretty adversarial. The aristocratic class had very little patience with young religions, people who belonged to that particular minority. If anything bad happened, I don't know if you know this or not, but much of the persecution over the course of several centuries that was aimed at Christians by the Romans, it was aimed at them because the Romans would say, why are these bad things happening to us? And people would say, well, it's because we don't follow the old gods anymore. There are too many of these new religions like these Christians. If we could get rid of them and worship our old gods, our old gods will bless us and we can resurge once again as an empire. It was a constant refrain in 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th centuries of Rome. Today, it's like, well, why do so many transgender people commit suicide? Well, it's because people won't accept them and love them as they are. And because they don't accept them and love them, those people become depressed and then they kill themselves. And you know the type of person who won't love and accept them. It's those Christian people. It's their values. It's the way they believe and think. So if we can find a way to minimize them and affirm all of these other ways in which people want to live, those people who want to find their own truth, live their own truth, apart from this repressive and unsophisticated Christian religion, then things will get better. There are those parallels, and they are unavoidable. And that's, so I share all that with you, not because I'm whining about it. Really, there are a few things that's more refreshing than when I sit down with a person who thinks that they know what Christians really are like, and then to have a conversation with them and to see this light come on. And they realize that what they had been told was not true. So there are all kinds of opportunities there for you and me if we are careful. So, in this series on 1 Peter, we understand that the purpose of 1 Peter is to prepare believers for persecution. And in part, that's why I'm doing this series for you and me, to prepare us for persecution on some level. whether it's because people don't believe what we believe or think what we think, or they're adversarial towards us, whatever. But it's to prepare our hearts and minds. 1 Peter goes on to tell those believers that they were born again to an eternal and living hope in Christ. And the way in which he describes that in the first chapter is nothing less than magnificent. The promises that are embedded in that chapter are wonderful. And if you haven't read them lately, you should. You should go back over and reread them. Peter goes on to say that believers will be persecuted for their faith. And as they are, he's saying, there's no hiding. Don't hide from those who are persecuting. Meet persecution with your holy living. In other words, let your life be separated in such a way that it's purposed to serve God and to give him glory and honor. And so there's no camouflaging yourself within the culture. Rather, be even more distinct through holy living. Show the sharp contrast of what it means to live for Christ with how the culture lives for itself. And that is an incredibly sharp contrast. He goes on to say, we are called out to be a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's own possession. And so he encourages them and affirms them in this manner. And then finally, what we've talked about was that in order to avoid unnecessary criticism and negative attention, we should be model citizens in any way that does not conflict with our faith. Which is why I think a lot of believers, for example, in our culture, are pretty rigorous constitutionalists. They see themselves by observing the Constitution of the United States. At one time, that would mean that you were a model citizen. Maybe not so much now for some people, but I think that's one reason why believers are pretty strict constitutionalists, because they see that as a way of being a model citizen. So if you have your Bibles and you want to turn to them, turn to 1 Peter 2, 13 through 17. And we're just going to refresh our memory on this text. 1 Peter 2, 13 through 17. Where the Apostle Peter says to them, be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether it be to the emperor as supreme, or to governors as sent by him, to punish those who do evil, and to praise those who do good. For this is the will of God, that by doing good, you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. So if you obey, and you are this kind of a citizen, you will help to put to rest all of these stupid things that people say that Christians really are. You can see the immediate application for us in this day and time. If we act as we should, as good citizens, as citizens of heaven as well, we will put to rest foolish things that people say about us. Live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants of God. Honor everyone. Love the brotherhood. Fear God. Honor the emperor. And so that was a text that I spoke on 2 weeks ago. And I shared with you as I wrote that this text belonged to one of four household codes that the Apostle Peter included in this letter. Those codes were designed to give guidance to Christians about how to be good citizens in the Roman Empire. So it's about the guidance and exhortation that the Apostle Peter gives to persecuted first century Christians who are citizens of Rome to submit to standard societal rules and codes in order to avoid additional criticism and oppression. That's why the Apostle Peter. So here are the four codes. Peter addresses these household codes related to the following institutions. I talked about this, but just by way refreshing your memory. The first of which is the citizen of the state. The next thing he talks about is slave to masters, which is what I'll be talking about next week. And if you want to pray for me, you can pray for me about when I talk about the biblical position on slavery as it relates to 1 Peter chapter 2. And then about wives and basically marital relationships that we find in 1 Peter 3, 1 through 6, and then husbands with 1 Peter 3, 7. And so this is just part of that. Now, here's the interesting thing. Let me just say this first. So in essence, whenever it did not conflict with God's law, the Apostle Peter and Paul counsel Christians to work at being model citizens. You and I cannot have a bunch of speeding tickets. We can't be the kind of person that has a reputation for being grouchy or a curmudgeon. It's always good if we don't have a long arrest record. It's good if people see that we volunteer our time for the community, that we're committed to helping others. I mean, the list is endless. But that's what helps us to establish ourselves as model citizens. Now, the second applicable exegesis of 1 Peter is about the nature of the relationship of the Christian and the state in regard to submission and obedience. And notably, in this particular text, we see in verse 13, be subject to everyone as supreme, to be subject to the emperor as supreme, and verse 17, honor the emperor. Now, here's the interesting thing. When I ask people, because I intentionally ask people, because I know that the content of this particular passage and how people might respond to it. But every time I said, what did you think of this particular? Almost everyone to a person said, "Man, we just got to figure out about how we're supposed to like honor people in power and politicians and." And what they did when they said that, and I'm glad they answered honestly, was that they took the secondary emphasis in this text and they made it the primary emphasis in this text. The primary emphasis in this text is this is how you ought to be good citizens so that you don't draw attention, undue attention, by being a lousy citizen and therefore being a poor witness for Christ. That's the overarching context. And Peter says, oh, yes, and by the way, one of the ways in which you do that is how you treat those in authority. But what most people took away from that was the secondary emphasis. And that was, just confusion or puzzlement or frustration with how we're supposed to treat people in authority. And they made that the big thing. That is not the big thing. The big thing is our witness. The big thing is, how do we live well in the world in which we find ourselves? That's the overarching context. And the Apostle Peter gave them four ways in which they could do that, one of which was how they dealt or treated those in authority. So then, notably, as we look at this text, notably then, verse 13, be subject to the emperor as supreme, and honor the emperor. And I mentioned to you that, that the Apostle Peter wrote this when Nero was the emperor. And Nero went down in history as one of the most evil Roman emperors in the history of the Roman Empire. And probably would go down in history as a whole as one of the most evil people to have ever ruled over an empire. So the question becomes, how do you honor the emperor? How do you submit yourself to a person like that? So let me ask you this question. Why would a text like this cause people like you and me so much consternation? Why does it bother us that the scriptures say submit yourself to those in authority over you. Honor the emperor. Honor the authority. Why does that bother us? That's not a rhetorical question. I'm actually asking the question. You know, you're welcome to answer. We see God as our authority. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And so we don't want to surrender that to a lesser authority, especially if that lesser authority is really, really compromised, right? Not that that ever happened, but just in case, you know. Okay, yeah, what else? We disagree with the authorities that are in place, don't we? Yeah, sometimes just really, strongly we disagree. Okay, so part of that might be just that rebellion is our natural, a part of our nature, and it is a part of our nature. And sometimes we rebel against people who are good, authorities that are good people, that we rebel against them. You were an authority over your child's life. I mean, that this all sort of falls in under that umbrella. And so when your child rebels against you, even when you intend and, in fact, are doing good, that's a very frustrating thing. So, I think it's no secret that because of the adversarial nature with which the church exists in our culture today, and the pressure that many of us feel from those authorities within our culture about how we should live or what our values should really be, many of us are feeling that frustration. How do we resolve this? And so I suspect that's why it's easy to make the secondary application the primary application given the circumstances that we live in today. But even with that, if we are to obey all civil authorities or magistrates, what do we do then with texts like these? And this is from Proverbs 24, verses 10 through 12. If you faint in the day of adversity, your strength is small. Rescue those who are being taken away to death. Hold back those who are stumbling to slaughter. If you say, "Behold, we did not know this," does not he who weighs the heart perceive it? Does not he who keeps watch over your soul know it? And will he not repay man according to his work? So, one of the classic examples of something like this would be Nazi Germany. Adolf Hitler was the Führer. He was the supreme ruler. And he had passed a number of policies that put millions of people's lives in jeopardy. Jews, gypsies, communists, and homosexuals. Those were his four primary groups. They were being led away to slaughter. They were not being held back. And so what does a Christian do? Do we get in the way of that? What about those corrupt nations or countries south of the border who are complicit in sex trafficking and human slavery? Or in the Middle East? Governing authorities who are a part of that. And they pass policies to allow that kind of stuff to happen. Do we not listen to them? Or do we obey them and just allow that kind of stuff to happen? This was a pivotal text for me when I was doing my thesis on genocide. And it figured prominently. In fact, I think the front page has this text on it. Because we are responsible as believers for people who are being victimized and persecuted unjustly, even by established authorities. that we have to be a prophetic voice and a countervailing force when those kinds of things happen. Or how about this? Matthew 5:39, "But I say to you, do not resist the one who is evil." This is Jesus speaking here. If a man slaps you on the cheek, he goes on to say, give him the other cheek to slap as well. How are we to understand this? So if a governing authority is evil, do we resist them? Do we not resist them? How do we apply this text? And please understand that there are many Christians who would take this text and they would link it with 1 Peter 2, 13 through 17, as well as Romans 13, verses 1 through 5, 1 through 7. Or this, "But Peter and the apostles answered, we must obey God rather than men." And so there was this, what you would call an ecclesiastical authority. In other words, the Sanhedrin said to Peter, James, and John, do not speak anymore in the name of Jesus. And they said, we must obey God rather than men. Well, that would seem, if they are an established authority who are ruling over the people that they are in charge of, then Peter, James, and John are clearly saying, we're not going to obey you. So then, I mentioned 2 weeks ago how this reading of 1 Peter 2, 13 through 17 should be read along with Romans 13, 1 through 7. And there in Romans 13, 1 through 7, Paul seems to break this out even more. And so, again, let me just say this. Romans 13, 1 through 7 is kind of a commentary, an extended discussion of what Peter alludes to. Now, Paul wrote this letter during the time of Nero as well. So both Peter and Paul wrote these letters during the time of Nero, all of which they talk about honoring the emperor and obeying authorities that have been placed over you. Just look at the dates here. I think it's interesting. The emperor Nero lived from 54 to 68, one of Rome's most evil rulers. The book of Romans precedes 1 Peter. It was written in 57 AD. And it begins with, be subject to the governing authorities. About 5 or 6 years later, the epistle of 1 Peter was written, where he says, be subject and honor the emperor as supreme. So let's look at Romans 13, 1 through 7. So if you want to turn to that in your Bibles or on your phone. Like Peter, the Apostle Paul offers these instructions to avoid providing additional ammunition to those who were critical of and adversarial to Christians. That's Paul's purpose here. So let's begin with verse 1. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed. And those who resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Now, I'm sure if you even have a smattering of history, you know empirically that just isn't true. That rulers all too many times, and especially if those the more power a ruler gets, the more he tends to be a terror to the people that he is in authority over. So how are we to understand this? For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear of the one who is in authority? Then do what is good, and you will receive his approval. For he is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid. For he does not bear the sword in vain, for he is the servant of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. Therefore, one must be in subjection, not only to avoid God's wrath, but also for the sake of conscience. This is that word conscience is the same Greek word that's used in Romans 12, verses 1, about making ourselves sacrifices, holy and acceptable to God. Verse 6, for because of this you also pay taxes, for the authorities are ministers of God attending to this very thing. Pay to all what is owed to them, taxes to whom taxes are owed, revenue to whom revenue is owed, respect to whom respect is owed, honor to whom honor is owed. So on the face of it, if you were to interpret this text in a very black and white fashion, if you were to decontextualize it from the culture and the time in which Paul was writing it, it would appear that regardless of what the authority does that is over us, what governing authority, what magistrate, what ruler, regardless of who they are, that we have to be submissive to them, no matter what they ask us to do. Now clearly, not only does that sort of, you know, make us concerned, it doesn't seem to ring true in terms of what we know about the whole of Scripture. How would you, for example, explain someone like Elijah? Right? I mean, because Elijah had an ongoing battle with Queen Jezebel. He refused to submit to her authority. And there are many other examples like that. One of my commentaries I read said, few passages have been the subject of such vehement swings in scholarly opinion in the 20th century as Romans 13:1-7. Look, I'm going to try and take a little bit of a deep dive in this, but I'm telling you, I'm just scratching the surface on this because there's much that could be said. But I do think this. I do think there are probably few things that I could be talking to you about on a Sunday morning that are more relevant than this passage and the meaning and the purpose of this passage. I think many, many Christians are at a loss as to how to conduct themselves in a world that's adversarial, where authorities are adversarial towards the Christian faith. And so what should our role be? How are we to act? What are we supposed to do? Now, you might find this to be interesting, that since the 16th century Reformation, the following has been the standard doctrine of our biblical understanding for the church and state. In other words, that for almost 400 years, there's been a quasi, almost black and white understanding that Christians submit themselves to the state. That it's been pretty standard for almost 400 years, and it came out of the Reformation movement, and it was proliferated especially among the Puritans in New England. And I don't know if you know how influential the Puritans were in New England, but they were phenomenally influential within our culture, in our legal system, in the legislative system, in the Constitution that you and I follow today. So here's a summation, and I'm going to go over some of it with you. Magisterial, so the word so a magistrate is another word for authority. It means teacher. But we use the word magistrate as an authority, a person who's been elected or appointed to have authority in some way over it. So it's a very broad term. Magisterial Reformation argued for the interdependence of the church and secular authorities. The magistrate, quote, the magistrate had a right to authority within the church, just as the church could rely on the authority of the magistrate to enforce discipline, suppress heresy, or maintain order. You know, a number of times I read from Chuck Colson's book, The Right Fist of Fellowship. It was a story about how a church body got into an argument. There was a conflict within the church, and so people in the church actually got into a bit of a riot during Sunday morning worship, and the state had to come in and restore order. So sometimes there are things that happen within the church where the state has to come in and restore order. And sometimes the state has to come in and say, you know, people who have disabilities need to access your building. And so those steps that you have there, or the fact that that ramp doesn't meet ADA requirements, that needs to be changed. There's that kind of authority too. But the Puritans wrote, the magistrate had the right to authority within the church, just as the church could rely on the authority of the magistrate to enforce discipline, suppress heresy. People who governed in the community had the right to suppress heresy. Now, it's important to note that there are two kinds of magistrates. There's the ecclesiastical magistrate, and there's the civil or secular magistrate. I don't know if you know this, but historically, Roman Catholics have always seen Protestants as ineligible, or their movement as uncredible, because they rebelled against the established authority of the church, and they have never reconciled themselves to that authority, and therefore the whole of the Protestant movement exists in rebellion to God's established authority. I don't know if you know that, but that's one reason why we've never gotten back together again. And then there's, of course, civil and secular authorities. So here are what the Puritans said about the church and civil authority. Follow me here. God, the supreme Lord and King of all the world, has ordained civil magistrates, secular magistrates, to be under him. Okay, so far so good. We think that's all true, right? That's what Carol was alluding to. Over the people for his own glory and the public good. And to this end, he has armed them with the power of the sword for the defense and encouragement of them that are good and for the punishment of evildoers. Now, I have another piece I want to get to later, and I don't think I'll get to it this morning, but I just want to say that even if an authority, even if a governing authority is evil, it serves them to have a civil society. Right? Because if their society completely breaks down and you have what's called anomie or lawlessness, then it doesn't serve them. So even Hitler had a very well-run society, even though he was really, really evil. So order is important. And even civil and secular authorities can keep order. And when that order is kept, everyone benefits from it. And since God is the author of order, therefore he authors civil and secular authorities to have some kind of order on some level so that everyone benefits. If it's all chaos, then only the strong survive. The second thing they said is, It is lawful for Christians to accept and execute the office of a magistrate. You can be a Christian magistrate when called there unto, in managing whereof, as they ought especially to maintain piety, justice, and peace, according to the wholesome laws of each commonwealth. So, in other words, if you're a Christian magistrate, then establish piety, justice, and peace. Use your power to do that. And for that end, they may lawfully now, under the New Testament, wage war upon just and necessary occasion. So they have significant power if they want to do that kind of a thing. Number three, this one is, I think, particularly interesting. By the way, let me just say this. What I'm reading to you comes out of the Westminster Confession of Faith. It was embraced by the Puritans. It is the document that shaped the doctrine of the church and state for 400 years. It's what I'm reading to you. I'm taking a deep dive here, but I'm saying this is where this comes from. The civil magistrate may not assume to himself the administration of the word, sacraments, or the power of the keys of the kingdom of heaven. So a secular judge has no authority to come in here and to preach or to do the sacraments or anything like that. Yet he does have authority, and it is his duty to take order that unity and peace be preserved in the church, so to protect the church, that the truth of God be kept pure and entire, that all blasphemies and heresies be suppressed, all corruptions and abuses in worship and discipline prevented or reformed, and all the ordinances of God duly settled, administered, and observed. For the better effecting whereof, he hath the power to call synods or councils, to present at them, and to provide that whatsoever is transacted in them be according to the mind of God. So they're saying secular or civil magistrates basically have a responsibility to ensure that the Christian world and life view is established in the community in which they live. Do you see the breakdown here? Because we no longer have a Christian world and life view in our culture. So we even more can no longer trust magistrates to sort out heresy or those kinds of things within the church. Now, believe it or not, there are some Christians who are still trying to catch up to this. Have I lost you? Are you guys following me here? Yeah, Jeff. Exactly. That's right. That's exactly right. And I'm going to get to that more, but I'm going to run out of time, I think. I'm going to get to that more, but what I'm saying to you is that all of us here have a residual memory of how these articles here dominated the doctrine of the church and state and how we should relate to the church and state. And the assumption was that because they lived in a culture, in a society that had a strong Christian worldview, that you could trust magistrates, people in authority, to enforce certain things that were true to the Christian faith. You can't do that anymore. Number three is almost irrelevant. Number four. It is the duty of people to pray for magistrates, okay, to honor their persons, okay, I mean, to be respectful, to pay them tribute and other dues, to obey their lawful commands. Look, if we don't support them with our taxes, they can't do their jobs, which is to establish peace and order and things like that, to obey their lawful commands and to be subject to their authority for conscience' sake. He's borrowing that from Romans 13. Infidelity or difference in religion, but religion doth not make void the magistrate's just and legal authority, nor free people from their due obedience to him, from which ecclesiastical persons are not exempted. In other words, just because you're a Christian, you belong to a church, doesn't mean that I get to not obey what the magistrate has to say, much less the Pope or any power or jurisdiction over them in their dominions. Everyone is subject to the magistrate, as long as the magistrate is exerting just laws, laws that are right and good. So maybe what I'll do here is I'll try and wrap this up because I don't want to take this into a next Sunday. If you have any other questions with me, you can talk to me afterwards because this is a huge big deal. So N.T. Wright says this. He says Romans 13, verses 1 through 7, that I am reading as a commentary also on 1 Peter, is not a charter for political quietism, but a warning against the wrong sort of resistance. It's not that we should resist, it's not that it's not okay to resist authorities when resistance is required according to God's law, which is supreme. We just can't resist against the wrong kind of thing. And that kind of thing Christians tend to get confused by. And so in the day of Paul and Peter, there were heavy burdens of taxes. And there were many people who resented paying those heavy burdens of taxes. And so they were protesting against that. And so both Peter and Paul did not want Christians to be associated with those people. They didn't want them being swept up with insurrectionists. Does this make sense? Okay, so that's why that's included in there. So one of the commentaries I have says this. In summary, Paul's argument is this. It is God's intent that human life in the context of community will be life in harmony and peace and order. Since life in community becomes chaotic and anarchistic without the presence of regulatory laws and enforced by authorities, the presence of these are part of God's overall intent for human existence. God wants order, and he will even use secular authorities, magistrates, to establish some modicum of order. Therefore, insofar as the state and its rulers exercise their authority in keeping with God's intent, they act as God's ministers for the common good of society. So as crazy as things are today, they could be much, much worse. I know that's hard to conceive of, but it's true. I could point some places out to you throughout the world where that would be true. So just a little word of encouragement. If, however, the authority of the state runs counter to this divine intent, then that authority should not be understood as God-given. In fact, it becomes quite clear from Revelation 13 and 18, where John critiques the Roman Empire, as well as other places in the New Testament, that the state which persecutes Christians, which dispenses injustice instead of justice, which supports moral decay, which tramples on the weak and powerless, has been usurped by demonic powers and forces diametrically opposed to God's intents and purposes. I think that's how many people think today. So what is the cultural hermeneutic of 1 Peter 2, 13 through 17, Romans 1, verses 1 through 7? The first thing we have to understand that this is an nomu. It is a principle. In general, we are to be subject to authorities. It is not a black and white thing. As a matter of principle, we need to be subject to authorities that have been placed over us. It's a general law or principle. Number two, secular, even evil governments offer order versus chaos. And in that way, God uses those governments to establish order, even when they do not follow him expressly. Number three, current civil unrest. So there was a current civil unrest in that time. and conquered people who were resentful towards Rome for conquering them, as well as people who were laboring under the burden of heavy taxes, existed alongside Christians, and the apostles Paul and Peter did not want them to be affiliated or associated with them so that the Roman government would sweep them up as a matter of people who were like insurrectionists. That also is going on culturally. Household codes and appropriate cultural assimilation. So both the Apostle Peter and Paul share with Christians, look, assimilate within the culture in a way that doesn't violate God's mandates on our lives. Assimilate. Be good citizens. And be in the world, but not of the world, when you do. It is also reflective of Paul's Jewish theocratic background. What you read in Paul in Romans 13, you could read in principle in many places throughout the Old Testament. That would what Paul writes in terms of his expectation in Romans 13 would be the same exact expectation that any Jew in Israel in the Old Testament would have had of their theocratic government. And then finally, I think this is really a lot about respecting and submitting yourself to the office of authority versus the person of authority. You can respect the office without having to subjugate yourself to the person. I am submissive to the laws of this state as they are reflective of God's laws. Where those laws require me to not be submissive, I cannot be obedient to. I have to obey God rather than man. But I do think that there are for many of us, there are people in government offices who have done nothing to, or very little, to encourage honor and respect. But that office they hold should be honored and respected. Because let me tell you, if you no longer respect that office and get rid of that office, then you have chaos and you have breakdown in civil society. So what that office stands for is very important and must be honored and must be respected. So much more could be said, but at the end of the day, I think that the commentary that I read to you summed it up best. That in any way that the governing authorities require of us to be subject to them, that do not force us to violate our commitment to Christ, we should be submissive to that. Actively, proactively be submissive and be good citizens about all of it. But where a government fully embraces things that are evil and wrong and unjust, and it becomes institutionalized, then clearly that has become infected by demonic forces. And then we work in whatever way we can to overturn that and make it good and positive. And that may begin just by voting or a whole host of other ways. But one thing's for sure, there isn't a person in this room that has the luxury to think shallowly about these issues. There is so much at stake, not only for us, but for people we love. And any of us who are grandparents or great-grandparents, we find ourselves tempted to say, this is not the world that we wanted to leave you. We thought it would be better. And so for what is left with the rest of our life, let's make it better. Let's honor what needs to be honored. Let's obey what needs to be obeyed. But let's live out our lives fully under the authority and the submission of God Himself.